like chit chat.
Okay, we're going to do 141 to 146 today. Lots of sacrifices.
Right along.
Yeah.
We've been on sacrifices for a long time.
And we're
going
to continue to be on sacrifices.
We asked that question before and we didn't know. There's a lot of sacrifices.
That's why we're going to buzz through a little bit. Okay, so the precept of the sacrifice of the Shlamim. So that's 141. That the Kohanim are commanded to perform the task of the Shlamim. Shlamim from Shalom, peace offering.
Or complete.
Right, in this case, peace Shalom, peace. You're right, the same
root. Which are the various ones.
Right, right, and so we'll talk about that. And so that, to offer it that way. So these are not the various ones, these are the various offerings. So
yeah,
all offerings are, all of the animal offerings are an olah, a burnt offering, a chatat, a sin offering, an asham, a guilt offering, and shlamim. We'll go into the shlamim. Okay, so for every offering that the community or an individual would ever bring, it would always be one of these. So he's written twice previously about the root reasons and how they can't be really discussed.
But we're going to talk about it anyway.
Well, not the root reasons, just about what they are.
Chatat
is sin. From the word chait.
Chait.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's shlamim are brought from sheep, goats, cattle, male and female, grown animals, and young animals, but no fowl.
So animals, not fowl.
Animals, not fowl. And young and grown each have their definitions. So young...
We had that thing with the birds. Was that last week, or did I read that in a...
No, I think that was like 2 weeks ago or something. Two, 3 weeks ago. We talked
with
about
the young birds and the old birds.
So this is animals. This is animals. Okay, so animals are young from 8 days old until the end of the first year. And if the year happens to have a leap month, still, it counts that calendar year, not 12 months, because there's some years with 13 months. So if the year is intercalated, then it's still that full year. So 8 days till the end of the first year. Then they're grown from 1 year to 3 years, but for sheep it's only 1 to 2 years. And after that they're considered old and they can't be offered. So you can do young, that's the first year. You can do grown, that's the second and third, depending on the animal. For sheep, just the second. And after that, they're considered old, and they can't be offered.
Oh, that's helpful. Don't qualify as an offering for old, huh?
Right.
Okay, then.
Well, so the animals don't.
Yeah.
It's not about humans.
Oh.
I think why we're dwelling on the offerings, besides the fact that, that's what's in the Torah. But part of it is to remind ourselves again and again, part of the message of today again. Hello.
Needs to air to your heart.
Hello.
Boy, Shvi Itanu. Boy, Shvi Itanu.
Oh,
okay. Let's see, where was I? The... Just lost my train of thought. All right. The point that we want to bring out today is again and again and again is that it's not compared to human beings. While you do see some similarities, so you're burning up an animal that is sentient and it should remind you of being a human being who's sentient and the difference is just the soul or whatever, things like that. You can't make a comparison and say, an older person.
No, I was being facetious.
I know, but it's a good point to make because it is a ceremony that we go through. It doesn't give God anything. It's all about us engaging in the ceremony. So how do we do it? Because you'll see that throughout. There's lots of ceremonial things here. It's fascinating. So fascinating and or boring, depending on your point of view. It's both, depending on when you're looking at it. So the shlamim. Where is my list of shlamim that I wanted to see? Shlamim of the community are called kodshei kodshim, holy of holies. Shlamim of the individual are called kodshei kalim, light holies. Kal is light. So individual ones are lightly holy, community ones are extremely holy. The community ones, they're offered slightly differently. Community one, could be two sheep that's brought with two loaves on Shavuot. And they're eaten by the Kohanim, except for the Amorim. Amorim are that category of parts that are burned on the altar. Similar to a Chatat and a Sham also have Amorim that are burned on the altar. And all the different details are discussed in Tractate Menachot. The Shlamim of the individual are called Katshe Kalim, lesser holiness. And the proper place for them and all their details is also Menachot. And here are the three times, the three types, okay? That's on the bottom of the page. Peace offerings of the festival celebration on occasions of joy. The second are, and those go, let's see, with bread. They go with bread, without bread, with, and the bread can either be leavened or not leavened. It can be fried or not fried. There's all kinds of different things. Amazing. The second is the kind that comes with certain known loaves, which is a vow or voluntary offering. These are called the Korban Toda. Let's see. And there's two types of those. And then the third type, so we do two, let's see. First is the festival of peace offerings, Korban Toda. And then the third kind is Nazir. And that also is divided. Right.
This is, you know, you could like spend a lifetime just studying all the.
Totally. You really could. There's
I mean,
so
there's
much
so
detail.
Many, and there's so many details, and there's so
many
distinctions,
detail.
And subdivisions, and all that. And
right.
Were there people who specialized? There must have been.
Yeah, the Kohanim. So that's
how could they remember all of this?
Well, so
plus all the other things
they
did.
Lived it.
Yeah. Well, so not all of them lived it. So imagine, medical school.
Right.
Okay. So the professors, as a group, know most of the information that we know today.
They have specialties.
Right. They have specialties, but as a group, their professors in medical school have quite a bit of knowledge. All the doctors that pass through get a lot, but when they graduate, they can practice. They do not have all the knowledge. They'll turn to somebody higher than them who knows more if they need it, and then they acquire quite a bit of knowledge over their lifetimes. But there's nobody really who holds all the knowledge, although there are some amazing individuals, geniuses, who hold significantly more than the general groups. So also with Kohanim.
So similar. Okay.
Yeah, so you know there are people who hold tremendous amounts, and there are people who just hold enough to be able to function appropriately.
To do their jobs.
Right. So here on page 101, just to make it more complicated, middle of the page, as to the laws of bread brought with the two kinds of peace offerings, the Todah and the Ram of the Nazir, out of how many Isronim, an Isaron is a measure of flour, how many measures of flour they are made, which of them were brought leavened, which were made of matzah, and if they were to be brought both leavened and unleavened bread, how are they to be divided up, and how the leavening was done, and then out of the sum of the loaves that were to be brought leavened, how many were to be baked in the oven, or baked as wafers, or mixed with hot oil and water, or, and later on it talks about, or fried, and how much, or if they were baked, if they were mixed with oil, and then baked, or mixed with oil, and then made into wafers, or mixed with oil, and then spread with oil, or not, and then spread with oil, or then deep fried, and there's all ways of making it.
And all the questions that come up if you don't do it quite right.
Right. All of that.
Like, mix up your bread.
Well, like the two sons of Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, you are...
Well, but they were extreme.
They brought a strange offering.
Yeah, but that's different than making a mistake.
Yeah, they were extreme. Mm. I mean, they did it on purpose.
They knew what they were doing.
They knew what they were doing. So it's a very strong thing, and it's a scary thing to think about. Here are two Kohanim who were trained in it, mm-hmm. who had legal access, legitimate access, and they chose to do something additional. They chose to make up an extra offering, and for that they were zapped. That's a message to all of us. Don't go making up things in Judaism. There's enough. Mm-hmm. Learn what we have and do that.
Well, the Torah can't be changed.
No, the Torah can't be changed. And so, but how is it applied can be changed. It's very tricky. And laws continually unfold. But we're not allowed to add on, or subtract mitzvahs. We do. It's so confusing, and I don't know all the rules of how you add and subtract, because we do add and subtract. That's the truth.
I'm going to say there.
We do.
It seems like there are.
You know, like Rabbeinu Gershom said, he made quite a few takanas, quite a few takanot, how do you say that, edicts. So one of them was that you can't divorce a woman without her consent. And another was that you can no longer have more than one wife. Actually,
he's the one
no longer more than one wife was first. And then can't divorce her without her consent came second, because that had to shore up the marriages that existed. Because let's say a man would say, okay, if I can only have one wife, so I don't want the ugly one. The ugly old one. I want a pretty young one. So if I can't take a second pretty young one,
I'll get rid of the old one.
I'll chuck the old one. Right? So then he had to make a law. Mm-hmm. You can't divorce a woman without her consent in order to protect
the old one.
The older, right. You know, heavier, saggy one. Doesn't happen to all women, obviously, but to many it does. So she's protected. Pardon?
It was not what?
It was over 1,000 years ago. 11, so he was about 1200s? In 900s.
Oh, 900s.
He's considered, Rabbeinu Gershom is considered the father of Ashkenazic Jewry. So he's right at
the 900s.
Split. Right, so 900s was the end of the Gaonic period in Babylon, and all halacha basically was based in Babylon at the time. The whole world looked to Babylon. Israel was on track B of halachic authority, but Babylon was the pinnacle. Babylon is the Ivy Leagues. Until 900, yeah.
This year?
Yeah. So from the destruction of the second temple, at the destruction of the first temple, when the Jews went into exile in Babylon, they set up study houses in Babylon, which remained in place throughout the second temple period. From at the end of the Esther story, when people came back to Jerusalem to reestablish the second temple.
That was about 423 BC.
That's right.
That
was about the second temple. The second temple was established.
The 70 AD was the destruction
of the second temple.
Yeah. Right, so we're talking about the establishment of the second temple. It was about 420-ish BCE. Right, so that's when they came back from Babylon, but they left behind a community. Not everybody came back from Babylon. As a matter of fact, few came back from Babylon. Many stayed in Babylon. And so Babylon, basically, that's Iraq, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The Iraqi Jewish community was in existence from the destruction of the first temple until about...
modern day.
Yeah, well, it's gone now.
That's what I said, until
1958, basically.
Very few.
There's like...
very few.
Ten.
Very few.
Eight.
It was.
I met someone at the Israeli Museum. Yeah. My relatives.
Yeah. There is a bit. It was a strong community until just after the establishment of the State of Israel when they were kicked out. So for over 2,000 years, it was a very strong community. And from the destruction of the Second Temple until 900, until Rav Chai Gaon was the last. He's not a Chai, he's a Chai Gaon, a Hay. He was the last of the Gaonim. And that Gaonic period was a time when all halacha was centralized in Babylon and the whole world, even though Jews were moving out, there weren't significant study houses outside of Babylon. Everybody sent letters to Babylon, and all authority was there.
So 10th century.
Yeah, 10th century. So so Rabbeinu Gershom, he was in the Germany area, I think. I'm not so good with the whole geography and if Europe.
Well, that changed all the time anyway.
So he was in that era. So he was the father, when they say he was the father of Ashkenazic Jewry, that means he is the one who took hold of halacha from there and brought it to Europe and said, we now rule ourselves. We have enough scholarship and we will make decisions ourselves and we will create halacha for this area, these Jews here.
And that's where the dividing thing
And that began the Ashkenazic track, and at the same time a Sephardic track was begun with Rabbi Alfasi, the Rif. He's the father of Sephardic Jewry. So the same thing happened in Northern Africa, basically, was that there was enough halacha at that point.
Now, did they outlaw multiple wives also, or they didn't?
They did not.
They did not.
So this was basically a Christian Europe thing. So it was for a few reasons. One is because of the Christianity of Europe.
Community.
So it didn't look good for the Jews. The Muslims had many wives, so it was okay for the Jews too. So they didn't, it was not an invidious comparison between the Jews and the Muslims. So that was one reason why they didn't. And one reason, it's not clear, he did not say why he did it. But one was that. Another reason is because Ashkenazic Jews, according to Beryl Wine, I can still hear his voice, I listen to all his tapes, is they never had a good day. Ashkenazi Jews never had a good day.
We talked about that. Basically, the poverty and the poverty suffering.
Was just
they just couldn't. They
awful,
couldn't support them.
Awful. Not only couldn't they be supported, but they were chased like crazy by the Christians.
Discrimination.
It was awful.
Harassment.
They were always on the run. Always on the run. Constant expulsions. That was not the case in Muslim lands.
Right.
So, and one of the things that he points out is the difference between sunny lands and cold lands. that sunny lands, people are nicer. Right. Food they're grows happier. Better, they're happier, they have a sunnier disposition. And that's where Jewish poetry came from, that's where Arabic poetry, but that's where that kind of creativity came from, as opposed to Europe, which was just like a bunch of shut down, cold people that were harsh and mean.
Think about those icky castles they lived in.
Yeah, so it was a hard... So one reason why he made that takana against multiple wives is because if you're going to be chaste, you might have to run with one wife and one set of kids, or the kids might get scattered, and 20 years later, a brother might marry a sister, because you don't know, like, the same father. But if you're chaste and scattered, then you don't know who's related to who. And so it was also to protect against that. Anyway, so that was Rabbeinu Gershom. Why did we get to him? Oh, yeah, so that is taking away something, because at the same time, he said no more polygamy, so then that also affected yibum, levirate marriage, where if somebody dies childless, then the brother marries. But what if the brother's already married? Right? So then he would be taking a second wife. Right. So he said no. So but levirate marriage is a mitzvah d'oraisa.
So what do you do?
So he said no.
So he took it away. So you
he did. So he didn't say it's no longer a mitzvah. He didn't actually take away the mitzvah.
He just said can't do it anymore.
It's not a mitzvah that we're practicing any longer.
And of which we have many.
Correct. And there is an antidote to yibum. It's chalitza, the removing of the shoe. Let's say they don't want to get married. They don't have to. Then she removes his shoe, spits in it, and there's a ceremony where they're undone. The only time that happens, it's extremely rare, that yibum happens, but my husband studied a case when he was in law school where the childless widow, was dumb. She wasn't able to speak, which meant she couldn't do the ceremony because you have to speak to do it. So she couldn't do yibum. So they had to actually marry, consummate, and then divorce. You can get divorced without speaking, but you can't do yibum without speaking.
Oh, wow.
How unusual.
Yeah. Yeah, so that it's
that
only
had to be traumatic.
Yeah, it's only cases like that. Which is a series
of circumstances.
Yeah, right. So you do it. So it's not that the mitzvah doesn't exist. That's the point. You're not removing it from the Torah, but you are taking it out of a general practice. Because it's not
so that you can do.
That apparently you can. So I don't know all the rules of that, but that apparently you can. Anyway, so here's all the shlamim. So we talked just in general. So again, we're going to hear tons about korbanot. We're not going to be experts when we finish because we're not going into depth at all. So 142. One of the korbanot, one of the shlamim, as we talked about, is the korban todah. From the korban todah, it's a specific mitzvah not to allow any of the flesh to be left over. You have to eat it all.
They must have eaten a lot.
Right. So did they eat a lot? I don't think they ate anything like we do today.
Yeah, probably. And there were a lot of them,
well,
right?
There were a lot of them,
and it fed the kohanim.
That's how they lived.
It is how they lived. There's been quite a bit written lately about how Orthodox lifestyle is unhealthy. And just in terms of how much food we consume.
Unlike the rest of the general population.
It seems like Orthodox Jews consume a little more, possibly, than the rest of the population. Especially because it's a kosher vice. You know,
you're
not, right. Really not supposed to be doing a lot of other
fun things.
So food's one of them. So not to leave any over. Now, it's interesting to look at 143, because we just said 142, don't let the flesh of a todah be left over. And 143 is the precept of burning leftover remnants.
I was going to say, it says right here, whatever is left of them, they have to burn.
Right. So they know it is going to be left over. Sometimes. It will happen. So I think it doesn't say here, but I'm understanding from this that you're probably not transgressing, and he doesn't say here in 142 either, does it? Usually you do have the right precept of this is in effect when.
And what happens?
What are the parameters? It doesn't say that in this one. So I think that I'm pretty sure what I'm inferring from this is you're not transgressing left over until you didn't burn it.
Gotcha.
Like, let's say you couldn't finish it all, or for whatever reason, there was a fire drill, and everybody had to run out of the base of Mikdash, and the time passed for eating it, right? So now you come back, you're not all over, you didn't all transgress, until you didn't do the right thing in 143.
Well, and it's weird, because 142 says you have to eat all of it by the morning, and then 143 says you have to burn it by the third day. So what happens?
happens between the morning and the next, you know, right. that you're missing a whole day there, I think.
Right. Let's see. I think you have, you have to eat it by the morning.
Well, doesn't this all refer back to the Passover offering? I mean, they had to finish it because they were leaving the next day. Actually, they were leaving very...
This is the thing. No, this is not Passover. This is
no, but 143 does. It refers to Exodus 12:10.
Mm-hmm. The burning.
You shall leave nothing of it remain, but that which remains you shall burn with fire.
Mm-hmm. You do have to destroy it completely, but it's not. It doesn't have to do with leaving quickly at all.
But that's not where we're getting this whole idea of...
No.
Okay.
No, there's a certain time period in which it has to be eaten.
Okay.
It's not because... It's not related
Nothing
to the fact...
Nothing to do with it.
Not related to the fact, as far as I understand,
okay.
not related to the fact that because they had to leave Egypt quickly, that every single sacrifice in the temple now has a limited time period.
Okay.
So what he's saying is that the reason why it has a limited time period is because it spoils.
Turns bad.
Right. Okay. This is an offering turned vile.
Right.
So it's
right.
a, it was the
Well, an offering turned vile is different.
Oh, different than
yes.
a spoilage.
Yes, is different. Pikul is different. We're going to get to that.
Okay.
So
it was partly reflective of the times that things didn't stay
right.
good.
Things didn't keep, right? So you don't want to have meat. You're not putting this in the fridge. So this does teach you that if you leave your Shabbos meat out overnight, you could probably eat it the next day. I've had friends who, like, I mean, I have one friend who, she left chicken in her oven. Oh, she turned off her oven Friday night. A lot of people do that. They heat up their oven, they put their food in, and they turn it off, and they mean to serve it Friday night, right? And they take it out of their oven. But she forgot it. So now it was Shabbos day, but it had been in the oven overnight, but the oven was off. Right?
So it really didn't.
So it wasn't refrigerated. It was cool, right? So she threw it away.
But it was cooked.
It was fully mm-hmm. cooked. But she threw it, but it was 12 hours unrefrigerated. More, 15 hours unrefrigerated. No.
I'm not that fanatic.
I would have eaten it.
Yeah, I would have eaten it.
So she didn't. So I told her she could. But this, in a way, shows that you could because it's saying that overnight it's still
right,
okay,
right.
really.
Yeah.
But that's when it spoils. So she, and especially I personally would have because it was in a sterile oven. Once you turn it on and you didn't open the door because you forgot it, right? The whole environment inside there is sterile until you open the door.
So there
probably
could
have
spoiled it anyway.
Probably not so much. But,
whatever.
Anyway,
threw it out.
Anyway, she did. So, but the reason why you're getting rid of it is because it's no longer edible.
Gotcha.
So you have your time limit. And a concept in it, not the reason that you're getting rid of it. I shouldn't say it that way. You do have a time limit. The reason you're getting rid of it is because you passed a time limit. Right. Pigul is different totally. Notar, so here are our vocabulary words at the bottom. Notar means leftover. From the word, for those people who are doing it in their Hebrew, yoter. Yoter means more than, more leftover. So there's more left in addition to, right? So that's leftover. Pigul, bless you.
That's like an evil thought, right? A pigul. Pigul.
Is that, where do you get that from?
From the Chumash.
Uh-huh, yeah, it is. It's a thought that's a negative thought, right? So pigul is a offering that is a vile offering.
Hello.
Because it was made vile because of the thoughts of the offering Kohen.
Whoa.
And nothing else. So if the Kohen offers it and says, I'm going to eat a part that's not permitted to me. Or I'm planning on eating this over the next 3 days, past the time. Just that thought makes the entire offering invalid.
Well, that's an interesting
yeah.
concept
yeah.
That about thoughts.
Yes.
Thought counts.
So that's what I wanted to bring.
Yeah,
now, that's our
see?
Point for today, is that thoughts make a difference. A huge difference.
And yet, we've had this discussion many times, that actions... The old,
right.
You know,
but you have to
are,
do the thing. There's very few things
yeah.
that thought make the make or break difference.
This
but,
is one.
But this okay. is one of them. Shema, for instance, if you say Shema, you say the words, it's a mitzvah, twice a day to say
you
Shema
say
Yisrael,
right,
Adonai, Elohim, Adonai, Echad. I just said a pasuk from the Torah, but I wasn't makabel ol machut shemaim. I didn't stop and think, okay, I'm receiving upon myself the yoke of the kingdom of heaven, and I'm now engaging in the mitzvah of saying the Shema. And then I say it, if I don't say it with that thought, then I didn't do the mitzvah. As opposed to, if
can
I...
Can you be thinking that thought while you're doing it?
Yeah.
Or should you stop and say that thought before you begin?
You could stop and gather that thought, like create a framework of that thought to say the Shema inside beforehand. Or you could be thinking it while you're saying it. But the main thing is to know that you're fulfilling that mitzvah and that you're receiving the yoke of the kingdom of heaven upon you by saying that. Just that first sentence.
So
if your mind wanders
example.
The rest of the time, you don't have to repeat it. But if your mind wandered during Shema, those six words, you have to say it again.
You can say it again. You have to, but you can.
Yeah, you could say it as many times as you need to. It's a pasuk in the Torah.
Okay.
You could say the pasuk 97 times until
using
you
using Hashem's name.
And using Hashem's name because it's a pasuk.
Okay. Oh.
Yeah, you can say a whole pasuk with Hashem's name in it.
But that is interesting because that is an example. This is another example.
But most things
we've talked about require action.
Everything requires action. And the question is action ever enough? So the answer is, in the halachic delineations, sometimes just action is enough. It's always best with thought, too.
Right.
So it's almost never that thought is enough. Almost never that thought by itself is enough. And sometimes it's the case that action by itself is enough. Sometimes you have to have both.
So here, really, it was action and thought, because
it's
the thoughts of the Kohen, but coupled with the action of actually having the thoughts the sacrifice.
Let's say he did the entire sacrifice exactly correctly. His actions were perfect.
But he had bad
thoughts. But he had the wrong thoughts.
Yeah, so that's pickle. What's the translation of pickle?
There isn't.
Okay. Moot?
No.
Lack of kavanah or lack of intention or
vile.
I mean, here he's translating as vile, but it's not really. It's like saying, "What's the translation of tame?"
Yeah.
There's not.
Right.
There's not. We just don't have one, so we try. Vile is not a translation of pigul, really. It's just what you could use in English,
evil
but it's not.
Thoughts.
Disqualifying thought.
Yeah. Disqualified from a thought. It's not even that he didn't have proper kavana, it's that he had negative kavanas. You know, he was thinking something wrong, as opposed to not thinking right.
Where is it about that he's talking about?
The very bottom of
103.
It's top of
107.
Yeah, but yeah,
talk
start, he talks here about lots of people.
Right.
In 144.
Right. So the thoughts do make a difference. Not to reference a movie at all, but in case, did anybody ever see Like Water for Chocolate?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's an interesting exploration of how thoughts make a difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's what that movie's about, really.
Yeah.
Is the thought investment in so many different things. So it's just interesting to see how we do have that concept in the broader human psyche that thoughts make a difference. So that you can invest things with your thoughts.
Well, Luzzatto talks a lot about how when we think a bad thought, we create an evil being, an evil kind of quote-unquote evil angel, evil spirit.
Through a thought?
Yeah.
Or through behavior?
A negative thought, yeah. In Tamar Devora, we studied, didn't we study that with you?
We did. Are you sure it's a thought and not a behavior?
No, it was a thought. Wasn't it a thought? If you're thinking, if you have like an evil intention or something,
I don't think so. I think if you create, you do create a creature.
Yeah.
Through what you do. I'm sure there are probably, if you would really think about how you're going to kill somebody, like you have that grudge and you plan it and you think, I'm going to go here, I'm going to get that, I'm going to buy this, I'm going to have enough money, I'm going to save up for it, I'm going to do this job in order to, like, probably if you go through all that, that probably is an avera. You know, so there are certain thoughts that are actually averas. Just having a negative thought, you know, I'm so mad at that person, I could kill them, I wish I could kill them, I want to kill them, that's not an avera until you start to
do something,
dwell on it.
Well, how can something like this, that then sort of this lack of intention, sort of create this vile?
It's a different thing. That's what I'm saying. One is creating the negative creature, that can claim your life. We did learn that, and that's in Tomo Devoro, which is not Luzzatto. That's the Ramak, or by Moshe Cordovero.
Cordovero.
That's just to keep the. It's okay.
It's hard to keep it all straight.
Sorry, everybody.
Right, no problem. But Luzzatto also talks about creating positive creatures. I mean, you do create.
You do a mitzvot. You create a you positive force.
When you do
in the world.
An action,
yeah.
you again, create an action. A force.
Okay.
That was when we had all the discussion.
When you
about
do a mitzvot or an aveira.
Yeah.
Or an aveira.
Right.
You do a mitzvah or an aveira, you create.
Positive or negative.
A force. Mm-hmm. Right? It's a positive force or a negative force. The positive forces are great. The negative forces, according to the Ramak, also need life sustenance since you created them and they're negative. They can't turn to God, which is only positive for their sustenance, so they can turn to you for sustenance. They can feed on you and your life energy. Mm-hmm. God, this is the concept of nosei avon, that God carries our sins.
Right.
He carries those negative creatures for us. He feeds them to give enough time for us to do tshuva so that we can destroy them. Mm. But that, again, I guess you could create one of those by thought if you have if you're really thinking a negative thought, not a fleeting thought that comes through. That's a different thing. Here, you're not creating a creature. I mean, you are because it would be an aveira in the end, but this concept of pigul is the confluence of behavior and thought is necessary to create the kosher offering. So if you don't have the correct thought, you haven't created the confluence necessary. One of the ingredients that you must have is proper thought. So you've now, if you didn't have that proper thought, you invalidate the offering. But not only if you didn't have the proper thought, you invalidate it. If you have the wrong thought, like I will transgress with the product of this proper behavior, then you've made it so that the whole thing is not you can't
so in a way, but
not just invalid, but it can't
but
be redeemed.
But here's
okay, go ahead. Well, I do see a similarity. I mean, I see a similarity in that we really have to keep, from the high priest to just a normal person, constantly trying to ascribe to a higher level of thought which controls
that
action.
Similarity is absolutely there.
Yeah, and the high priest is sort of the epitome of that. Mm-hmm.
Wait, and this is not even the high priest.
But my question is, let's say this is one of those individual offerings. So I bring the offering.
Right.
That's a, it was a thanks offering or a todah or whatever. And I have the right intention and motivation in bringing it, but I turn it over to the Kohen.
And he blows it.
And he basically, so that allows the actions, the thoughts, coupled with the actions, of another person to sort of negate my behavior.
Right.
And so that's sort of a weird thing.
You're trying to redeem yourself.
It is sort of a weird thing.
So I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know how that works. I mean, that's a real lawyer question. That's a real Gemara question.
Yeah, I mean, that is really...
And I'm sure it's been discussed.
Oh, I'm sure. You think?
But who... Like, okay,
maybe
so let's say that...
I'll write reference.
I think you get your credit for doing what you did.
Well, but I don't know.
I think you should ask. I think it's a great question.
Wagner.
Yes, ask him for sure.
Question. Okay.
Because the question really is, okay, let's say the Kohen, you bring the right animal, you have the right kavana, you did the right tshuva, now you give it to the crummy Kohen, right? Kohen who has the wrong kavana. So now, the question is, did you accomplish your task? And if you didn't, do you need to redo it? And if you need to redo it, who pays?
And how do you know? How do you know? That's first of all, it's how do you know? Then
right, so that, we have four questions so far. Did you accomplish? And if you didn't, do you need to redo it? And if you need to if you didn't accomplish, how do you even know?
But if she did it,
and if you need to redo it, who pays?
And you have to bring the answer back to this.
It's common Torah thought that if you intend to do a mitzvah and you're prevented from doing it, you get credit for it. Just
absolutely.
Like you,
that is typically the case, but this is also unusual, though.
That's true, but not in all.
Because here you're relying on someone else to...
What if somebody completed?
Right. Should know what they're doing.
What if somebody sells you...
Well, that's bad thoughts. That's the trust.
What if somebody sells you chametz matzah? Right? You now eat that matzah.
Thinking it was good.
Thinking that it's fine, right? So it really is a question. Did you... There's two questions there. Did you fulfill the
Does
mitzvah?
Does it have a proper heksher on it?
Yeah, it has a proper heksher.
It should be protected.
But you're not all the way. That's what I'm telling you. You're not. Okay?
If you ask a shayla and a rabbi answers you,
that's totally different concept. Totally different concept.
I don't think so.
It is. It is. It is. Because one is about how the principle of how oral law works, and one is something else. So the question is, because there's a physical reality to the spiritual reality.
Right.
So if you ate that chametz matzah on Pesach, now you have
proper, effort. To find kosher chametz.
Hang on.
And you end up with a product that's got chametz in it. You have no way of knowing that.
Right. So then you have two questions. The question is, did you fulfill the mitzvah of achilat matzah? Right? Because you have a mitzvah to fulfill, a positive commandment of eating the matzah. Did you fulfill that mitzvah? And I would say the answer to that is no, you didn't fulfill the mitzvah, even though you tried. Now, does machshava kamaisa, the thought is like the action, apply there? I'm not sure. That's a question. And the second question is, what's up with the eating of the chametz that you ate? So you certainly don't get karet, because you did do your fair effort. Karet is the punishment for eating chametz on Pesach.
Cutting off of the soul.
So you don't get karet because you didn't do it on purpose. And you didn't know. However, you still incorporated chametz into your physical being, which hurts you somehow. And so tshuva does need to be done from that. Now, let's say you don't know.
There are korbanot for not knowing.
For not knowing. And on Yom Kippur, you say, Achet, for the sins that I did knowingly and unknowingly. That's a sin that you did unknowingly. But
so
it is a sin.
In Yom Kippur, that would
right. It's a different level of Aveira, and it's an easy one to do tshuva from, because you are being careful, you are looking, and so you certainly never intended to eat something wrong, and so you absolutely would regret instantly anything wrong that you did like that.
Well, you probably would never even find out.
You might not. You might. Once the scandal breaks that so-and-so figured out that crackers are worth $18 a pound, and so somebody spent $1 a pound making a bunch of crackers and selling thousands of pounds for $18, and then it breaks in the newspapers the day after the Seder, and you find out, oh my gosh, I ate the Kraft Meiker matzahs. Right. Right. So... Right, so that could happen. And so then you know quickly to do, you know, tshuva for that. And then you have to worry about all, you know, what's in your kitchen and what's made chametz. It would be a whole huge
kiddula.
Oh my gosh. It would be
Let's
huge.
Not even think about this. I think this is a bad thought vein. It's a bad vein of thought.
It's giggle.
Yeah, if you want to really go neurotic before Pesach.
Yeah, I think this is not something that's a good thing.
With chametz tikka matzah that's sold basically in the same place,
right?
Pesach tikka matzah, if you go to the supermarket, it's very easy to pick up a box of matzah.
Yeah, that's why it says not for Passover use.
You don't see that.
Right.
Yeah, you do have to see it. But supermarkets make mistakes. Supermarkets put it on the shelf, so you do have to be careful. Yeah, that the housewife must be vigilant. Right.
Buy the deli.
What?
Buy at the deli.
Right.
So buying at the, she's saying the answer is buy at the deli, where you could be sure. Right. Because it really is a risk. It really is. You just never know. And you have to check and check again. Things you thought had a hechsher sometimes don't.
Right. You have to check every time.
You do. Okay. So anyway, that's an important point that I wanted to bring about the concept of pikul, which we're going to get to right now. So first it talks about the concept of pikul before it really talks about what it is. But
is there another handout?
No. Here, you can have this one. You can share, because I don't need it. Mm-hmm. Except for I'm just going to move these over. Oh, you have, there's some too. Here, excellent. Perfect.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Great. No, I'll take that. This way. Perfect. Okay. So, right, so you have to burn it. So any leftover, any notar, and any pickle has to be burned. I put right here at the bottom, gezeira shava. Gezera shava means an equivalent. Shava means equivalent. Shave is equivalent or equal. It's the equal sign. For those who are studying Hebrew, you can say achad plus achad shave l'shtayim. So shave means the same. Shivui, mishkal, is equilibrium. Anyway, so Gezeirah Shavah is where you learn one thing from you learn two concepts from one statement where there's something equal. So, for instance, in this case, you learn that both notar and pigul have to be burned. I think you might actually, in this case, learn that they both have to be burned from the fact that they have the same punishment. But I'll just give you an example of what it could be like. You might say, let's see. Well, I'll just try to use this, but I don't want it to sound... if it says one A should be burned and B should be burned, and A has the punishment of karet if you don't burn it, then you could learn that B would have the punishment of karet if you don't burn it, even though it didn't say it. Right? That's called a Gezeirah Shavah. When you learn, because of the same language in both, you can learn one extra detail about the second one that didn't have it listed from the first one. That's a Gezeirah Shavah. Of course, there's details for that. But just the concept, right? You can't apply it all the time. All right, now let's look at pigul. So here's your definition. Pigul is an offering about which the Kohen who attended to it entertained a disqualifying thought. Mm-hmm. So disqualifying thought, not no thought. Disqualifying. He entertained, and it didn't just fly into his mind. He entertained it. That's a difference also. That's important. That's what Rabbi Shragi Friedman said. I'm on page 107, 144. Rabbi Shragi Friedman said a great statement that I repeat a lot now, that you can't control if a bird flies over your head, but you can control if he makes a nest in your hair. Right? So thoughts fly in. And you can chase them out. You cannot control a thought flying in. But you can control if you're going to ponder it. That's up to you. So, right? That is good, right? And that applies for a lot of different things, from your kavana in Shemona Esrei, to how you feel about other people, to how you feel about mitzvahs that you want to do, to how you're trying to, whatever it is, that's specifically often used for boys, and how they're supposed to control their thoughts for certain things. They can't control, a teenage boy can't control, you know, thinking about a girl for a second, but he can control if he fantasizes. He does not have to do that. That's up to him. That's a proactive thing. So we also, in many different areas of our lives, cannot control a fleeting thought. But whether
you dwell on it.
Rabbi Shragi Friedman. But if you dwell on it, or if you enlarge it, that's totally up to you. Yeah. Right. So if he entertains a disqualifying thought while it was ritually slain or offered up, then the meat would be called pigul. It would be a disqualifying thought if, for example, he decided in his mind that at the time of the ritual slaying or while it was being offered up that he would eat of that offering after the time allotted for it, or that what had to be burned of it he would burn after the time allotted for burning it. For what the altar consumed by fire and what man consumes by eating would both be signified by the expression of eating. So it's interesting. In this particular case, both together, and here's another Gezeirah Shavah, right? The eating and the consuming, the burning and the physical consume. They're both consumed, one by fire, one by mouth. Mm-hmm. That's Gezeirah Shavah, is learning the consumption concept there. So they both would have to be burned then. Right. So I think that's enough of that one. Pretty much, let's see. And he does talk about the punishment and offering it up on the third day. Let's see if I can find that one here.
Said it has to be burned in the daytime.
Right, it has to be burned in the daytime, but why the second day?
The third day.
I know, but why? What's with the second day? You have to eat it by the end of the first. You have to eat it by morning of the next, of the second day.
Well, it said here, because I just saw that, and it said here, it says that sacred meat left past its time was to be burned only in the daytime, for it is stated on the third day shall be burned with fire. Thus, even though shlamim are forbidden to be eaten from the start of the second night. So that's why it's
the start of the second
day.
Night.
Yeah.
Oh,
so in other words, you could eat it.
Oh, so maybe it's preferred
day.
That you eat it by the morning, but you still have a grace period.
Apparently.
Possibly?
I don't know. But I saw that and I thought, and then you have to wait
and then you have to wait
because
you can't
morning.
Burn it. Right.
Okay.
Where'd you see
that? That was on the bottom of page 105. The very bottom. Sacred meat, it's in that paragraph.
So you couldn't burn it at night?
Correct. No, you can't burn it at night.
So it does look like you can eat it during...
Maybe you can't eat it then, you just can't burn it.
Well, it says, even though they are forbidden to be eaten from the start of the second night. So
it
that
may
would mean...
But maybe here,
because of how time runs from night to night, maybe.
But you have to finish it by the morning.
Well, I know,
so what's with the morning to the night?
It says they might be burned only during the day. Might be.
No.
That's there was a thing in here.
That's English language meaning can only be.
Can only be.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. You're right. It said that. I remember because
I'm just wondering
with
the second day. What's the story with that? So it's interesting with Pigul. If you're not sure if it's Pigul, so then now what do you do?
Do you assume it is? Of course, if you assume it is, and it's not, then you...
So if you assume it is, and it's not, then you destroyed something kadosh.
Right.
So what you do,
but if you didn't fulfill the mitzvah of eating it.
And you didn't fulfill the mitzvah, and right, and you so then you wasted something kadosh.
Right, so that's bad.
Right, so that's bad. But if it was, and you ate it,
then that's
then
really
you
bad.
Transgressed eating pigul,
and that's
you can't
really
do that,
bad.
Right?
That's worse.
So what do you do? So this is what you do. You leave it over till it becomes notar.
And then
for sure you have to burn it.
Right.
Oh,
okay, that makes sense.
That's how you
take care of it. So you sort of just let it rest.
You let it rest.
That's like ignoring the bad thing, or potential bad thing.
Not ignoring, of just making it so
Well, making a conscious decision.
You're using time to make sure that you're doing the right thing.
That you don't transgress out of ignorance.
Right. Right. Sort of like, in a way, it's like Shemitah here. Right? You're not allowed to throw away Shemitah produce, any of it. So you get a cucumber, you don't feel like eating the peel, so you're allowed to peel it, but you can't throw away the peelings, because it's Shemitah Kadosh produce. So what do you do with those peelings?
Feed it to birds. You put it in your compost.
You
feed it to birds.
You set it aside until it turns into garbage. It's not garbage. It's fresh, good Shemitah food after you peeled it.
But at some point...
But in a day or two, it's going to be
garbage.
It'll be spoiled and disgusting, and then you can throw it away. But it's not disgusting when you first peel it. You have to save it until it's garbage. And then you can throw it away.
They do this every 7, what is it, every 7 years?
Uh-huh.
Can you just put it in your, composting thing?
I don't know.
Because that's basically what happens. If you put it in there, it just turns into garbage.
I actually had it sitting on her counter.
Right, they have a Pach Shemitah. Yeah. And I don't know what they do with it. Can they turn it into compost? I don't know. Then is your compost kadosh? I don't know.
Too many questions.
It's very, very tricky stuff.
This is a cucumber
peel.
That was grown
during the Shemitah
year.
Yeah.
That you were allowed to eat.
You're allowed to eat Shemitah produce. Oh, you're not allowed to plant and tend.
I don't understand.
If it just grows by itself.
Okay.
This was from a seed. This was from a seed that was left over from you.
The apple orchard in the Shemitah year still gives apples.
Uh-huh.
You're allowed to eat those apples.
But you can't throw away the peel. You can't. What about the core? No.
It's kadosh.
So you have to find a way to use the entire...
No, you're not going to use the entire thing. You could just let it sit. You're not allowed to throw it away.
There you go.
Yeah, you could put it in one of those high-processed blenders. Get a lot of extra fiber.
In a smoothie.
Yeah. It'll be that smoothie with the stem and the pits, too. But
they do it. It does. Like, I put in whole kiwis.
Interesting. And you look marvelous, so it must work.
Thanks about that.
Okay. Let's see. 1:45. That the flesh of defiled holy offerings is not to be eaten. This is where it pays to look at the Hebrew. Shelo le'achol basar kodshim shenitmeh. Do not eat the precept of not being able to eat holy meats, holy offerings, that became tameh. So here it says defiled. What does that mean? Doesn't mean, that you opened up. Like, let's say USDA defiled would mean the guts opened up and the excrement of the animal defiled it and you can't eat it. That's not what it's talking about. This is talking about tummy. It got tummy somehow. Somebody came in, a ritually unclean person, touched it or something like that. So now you can't eat it anymore. So what do you do with it? But the main thing here is that the flesh cannot be eaten. So once it becomes tameh, you can't eat it. So it's not that it becomes, You might think once it becomes tamei, it now becomes not holy, and anybody could eat it. Right? Now you can, now it's just family food. It's not ritual food anymore. Not the case.
Nobody can eat it.
Nobody can eat it. Right. And that's one of the reasons why things have to... This does it say this has to be destroyed by fire? That's one of the reasons why the notar and the pigul has to be destroyed by fire. We skipped that part.
To make sure nobody eats it.
To make sure that nobody, animal or human, eats it. And it's, that's how utter destruction is caused, is by fire. You could cut things up into little pieces and scatter them to the winds, but still, they could be consumed. So fire destroys completely and utterly.
So just point of information. So assuming that all of these laws were, you know, during the time of the temple, and the priests were the ones that were handling these sacrifices anyway, why would an unclean person be at all involved in handling these sacrifices?
Because you might take it. It's, you brought your korban toda.
Right, but you're handing it over to someone
who's and then he hands it back to
clean.
You. Then he hands it back to you.
And you're not clean.
You are. Let's say...
But they're doing the sacrifice for you.
Mm-hmm. And then they bring it back to you to eat. Your part. You have certain parts that you get to eat.
Yeah, but, I mean, so that's assuming that everyone that comes to make a sacrifice has to be...
Has to be tahor. But let's say something happens in between. You went out shopping while they were offering it. I don't know.
Oh, okay.
Or you touched somebody,
or you brought it,
or
you brought it home to eat it.
Okay.
Right? And now your son comes into the house and he was just, you know, at a funeral.
Okay.
Or he just killed a mouse.
So you have to stay in this absolutely pure state once you get it back.
I don't know how anybody ever did all this stuff.
Yeah. It was hard. It was hard.
It was really,
but they had
hard.
A heightened consciousness. I mean, the same way that we have a heightened consciousness, it's not the same, but we have a consciousness about germs. Right, we think about it regularly. We think about it when we leave the bathroom. We think about it when we touch a handle. Right?
We're thinking about it.
Who didn't wash their hands when they touched this handle? Ew, I don't want to touch this handle. So, and we are all being trained now how to wash our hands, right? You turn on the faucet, you wash your hands 20 seconds, saying happy birthday, make sure you get here, right? You're washing your hands, you turn it off with your elbow, right? You hopefully just get to wave your hands. If you don't just get to wave your hands, take your towel first, keep it under your arm so that you don't have to touch it. Right? And then
you're right.
Dry your hands, save your towel, use
to open
that
the door,
to turn
right?
the handle, and then throw it away.
And then you hope that there's a wastebasket there.
Right? But how do you keep all that in mind? Well, we do, because we've all been trained now. Right? So we're being trained. Like, everybody is thinking germs now. So, and I for sure think about when I'm at the table, and I, because I have a heightened germ consciousness. Now we have a whole Shabbos table full of people, and somebody says, "Hey, Chu, can you please pass the chillin?" And they take the serving thing. I'm like, "No, I'm not taking any more chillin."
There you go. It's a good diet thing.
Yeah. So.
You know, when you're surrounded by little kids, it's pretty hard to be. So
really hard. Really
I mean,
hard.
It's pretty hard to be so focused. I'm sorry.
Anyway, the point is we are capable of heightened consciousness about things.
So did everybody who was...
Everybody was
around
trained in Tumah and Tahara. And it was a very significant training.
No wonder nobody wanted to be Jewish.
Right.
I mean, think about it.
It was really hard.
Think about it.
It was a significant training. And for the reason of keeping this training alive in us, and this is the only reason that we do it, as far as I understand, we all wash our hands before we eat bread.
Right.
That's why we do it. Mm-hmm. We don't, that's not, wasn't
it was,
actually
it was
necessary.
A cleanliness thing.
Right. That wasn't necessary for every Jew to wash their hands before they ate bread every time. We do it today in order to hold the memory and the consciousness of Tumah and Tahara so that it doesn't die from our thoughts. So each one of us has a piece in carrying the memory and the consciousness forward just in that tiny little thread. Washing before you eat is tiny compared to all this Tumah and Tahara. So much stuff with the mikvahs and all over the place and all the laws. Do you have to wait 7 days? Do you have to wait 1 day? If you touch your head, if you kill a mouse, if you kill a bug, how big is the bug? You know, if you walked into the branch of a tree that was over a grave, look, all these things you have to know. And people did know. So our tiny little thread that we all carry forward is washing for bread. And that keeps the memory of Tumah and Tahara consciousness alive in the people of Israel so that when we get back to a place of heightened consciousness, we'll be able to assimilate it. We have the doorway still open. But we don't have all that knowledge in us, but the doorway is still open for all that knowledge. Okay, so we have 145, we did 146, the precept of burning hallowed flesh that became to me. So not only can't you eat it, but if you can't eat it, what do you do with it? You burn it. Right? And that's all. There's a whole long piece of it. Oh, it's interesting. So what do you do with the bones? You don't have to burn the bones. Except the bones of the Paschal sacrifice. Why? Because there is the halacha only by the Paschal offering that you can't break the bones. So since you can't break the bones, you're going to be careful. You're not allowed to gnaw the bones either of the Paschal sacrifice, which means that the bones of the Paschal offering, we might have a little meat left on them. Because you're not eating the bone. You're not allowed to pick it up and eat it, and you're not allowed to break it. So that means that it's still, that could become spoiled. The Paschal bones, as opposed to other bones that you are allowed to eat the meat off of. The Paschal bones might have meat left on it and might become spoiled. Therefore, those burns also require burning.
But bones actually burn?
Yes.
If it gets hot enough. Well, yeah, when it's trimming people, all there's left is ashes.
That's pretty high temperature.
Right, so I guess if it gets hot enough.
Right. And you probably don't have to make the whole burn turn into powder, the bone turn into powder. You just have to get all the meat off of it in the burning here. And so it just says on here, 117, the second paragraph, now these are the items to be burned, sacred meat that becomes defiled or was allowed to remain too long, so that's pigul or notar, or an animal offering that became disqualified or unacceptable. Also a mincha offering, so it's not animal, that became disqualified or defiled, or was left over too long, and a Hashem Talui, whose owner found out before its blood was sprinkled that he had not sinned. Remember we talked about Hashem Talui's?
Right.
So now you hear there's a whole matzah scandal. Right? You ate matzah. Mm-hmm. But you're a super meticulous housewife. Oh, you're a super meticulous recycler. Mm-hmm. And recycling was the day before the Seder. And so you stacked all your matzahs and put all the boxes in recycling to make sure they'd be taken, right? And now you have all your matzahs without boxes, right? So you don't remember what brand you bought, right? So now you're not sure, am I part of the matzah scandal or not? Did I commit a sin or not? I don't know. And the person who bought it for me is in Timbuktu. They're out of communication range. I can't talk to them. So I'm going to bring the Hashem Talui, the maybe I did an Avera offering. But now, before you sprinkle the blood of the Avera offering, the person comes back from Timbuktu and texts
you,
you're
not.
Kosher matzah. And you read the text, and you're like, wait!
Wait, okay. I didn't do it! I didn't do it!
Right. That has to be burned. Okay. Okay, a chatat of a fowl brought over a matter of doubt, a hair of a ritually pure nazir. So a nazir that did not become tamei, he cuts off his hair at the end of his nazir status. His hair is burned. Fruit of a tree's first 3 years, which you're not allowed to eat, that's burned. And mixed crops raised in a vineyard. Those are things that you're not allowed to eat. And we'll get to that, hopefully. Whatever's not for burning, such as liquids, juice from the fruit of a tree's first 3 years, and mixed crops raised in a vineyard shall be spilled out. Right? So spilled out, that can get rid of it. Burning gets rid of the actual fruit itself. Right, so that's what has to be burned. And then there's other things here. Along with this, I guess I'll just read this paragraph too because it's interesting. Along with this, in its wake, let us write those items that were to be buried.
Which is interesting.
These were consecrated animals that died. So you said this animal is going to be for a sacrifice, and then he dies a week later, you have to bury him. Whether they were consecrated for the altar or for the maintenance of the temple. If consecrated animals miscarried, the stillborn young were to be buried. Even if it delivered only placenta, it was to be buried. And an ox that was stoned to death had to be buried, a beheaded calf, the birds of a matzora, the hair of a nazir that became tamei, the first, because he has to start his whole period again. So his hair is buried. The firstborn donkey, meat boiled in milk. That's interesting. And non-holy animals that were ritually slain in the
weird.
Temple forecourt.
What's that? Yeah. How does that happen?
Right, that is a good question. Let's see. Let's see if it tells us. Non-holy animals that were originally slain in Talmud court. Yeah, I looked at that footnote before, and all it gives you is a tract, Talmud Bavli Truma.
Yeah.
So, sorry, put that on your list for questions.
I'll just do one question. Four questions.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
I'm not.
So these are all things that... So we have the burned things, we have the buried things, but there are ways to dispose of the things that we're not supposed to have around. Let's see. Anything else you want to do in this one? No, that's really the end of this. Good. Okay. So that's it for today. So taking away the thought for today, that thought makes a difference. And we are required to work on our thoughts. Can't control if a bird flies over your head, but you can control if it makes a nest in your hair. So
no class next week.
No class next week.
No class next week.
But there will be a class the week after. That's right.